If it's local and it matters, it's Above the Fold with Steve Stewart on Real Talk 93.3.
Welcome to Above the Fold here on Real Talk 93.3. I'm your host, Steve Stewart. We're here every Tuesday and Thursday, and it's Tuesday. So here we are. Hope everyone had a great holiday. I never left town, and it was fabulous. Cold weather, fires, football. Boy, I wish I had a sports show. A lot to talk about in college football. Anyway, that's coming up after this. But thanks for joining us. We've got, it's been quiet on the local political front. So we will do our best to get you up to date on a number of things. I've done some research. We're going to talk about a couple of multi-use paths. You know, who can be against multi-use paths? Because so many people can use them, right? But there's a couple of things. You know, obviously there's been a move to try to get people out of cars. I don't know if this is what this is about. This is just more about increasing a quality of life. And as we've seen, no good deed goes unpunished. I mean, there's going to always be people against something. And it's with social media has made it so much easier. The pandemic allows you to zoom into a meeting. What's more convenient to just zoom into a meeting and complain about, a host of issues? Now, this is not to minimize public participation in meetings, because we've got to have that, but it makes it a lot more difficult for political leaders to make decisions because they are being confronted now by people in a much different way. And I've watched a couple of these blueprint meetings, and you can just see the impact that it has. It seems like, I guess, because of the political environment, the polarization. I think the blueprint vote on the Northeast Gateway, it was just like torture, delaying the inevitable and just getting more, trying to get more information. And again, in a way it's good, but when you want to hear all voices, but that doesn't mean that all voices are equal. And I think that's something that elected leaders are going to have to, they're going to have to resign themselves to understanding. And so there's a multi-use path that is being considered down Thomasville Road. And there's another path that is being designed. They'll have public input for that in January. We'll go over the specifics from Tallahassee to Monticello. And again, these are the types of things that I thought were good ideas, but we'll give you one person's perspective on this Thomasville Road path. And it's a doctor who's concerned about safety. And so, we'll detail that. And then we'll also give you some details on the, Tallahassee Monticello, multi-use path. And it'll be interesting to see how the elected officials deal with all this. We'll also talk about, there's a blueprint meeting on December 9th, and there is a group of people that are trying to get them to reconsider the $20 million that was allocated to FSU for improvements to the Doak Campbell Stadium. And so some big names were there. It was hosted by the NAACP and the president, Mutki Akbar, led the discussion. And so the WCTV did a report on that. There was a quote in there from Bill Proctor, who actually supported the money for FSU. And he's got a great line. And that's not a shock with Mr. Proctor. So we'll talk about that. And we'll talk about the general. Again, this is something that fits into this local media, or fits into the media and the local politic angle that I want to talk about a little bit. You know, we saw over the last week, the media really screw up on a couple of things. One of them was a conservative-leaning issue, which was, if you saw on Twitter, I don't know if it was reported here, we didn't do a report on it, but Pelosi had bought a $25 million mansion in Florida, and that made its way through conservative Twitter. I saw it, thought it was true. Like I said, we didn't write on it, but it turns out that it's false. And there's some, there's some pretty high level people with egg on their face because they've shared the tweet. I read a story about the anatomy of a lie, and it's amazing what's happening now on social media. And you've got to be extremely careful. You know, it's one thing, and we saw that this weekend too, on related to coaches going other places. You know, people do this just for fun and come up with pictures, you know, from 3 years ago or something. And, you know, when you're talking about football coaches, it's funny. You get these fan bases that are looking to believe anything. And so so that's one thing. But when you're talking, you know, we get into the world of politics and you know, decisions that really impact people. It's starting to happen. It's starting to happen there. I mean, the Pelosi issue is one that was very blatant. And, you know, they use words like rumor has it, or they put in the word may so they can sleep at night. But, I mean, it was all started as a way to get clicks. And that's what this is all about. Maddie, did you guys report on that, Pelosi buying a house?
We did not say anything about that on the morning show. Just there wasn't enough credible information on it.
So you did research it. You were aware of it, yes. Yeah. And so, yeah, if you take the time and look at it, that's why I'm a little concerned. You know, there's somebody pretty high up in the DeSantis administration shared the tweet. And so you would think that you would start looking for credible reports. But anyway, that was one issue. The other thing, you know, is this issue with Rittenhouse and his acquittal. That happened while before we were our last show. But, you know, one of the issues there is the reporting. You know, talk to a number of people who thought that those that the victims were African American, and that's just unbelievable to me. And I think it goes back again to the media not really getting the story out there. They, you know, look, you can report lies and then you can not report the truth. And that can also have the same effect. And, you know, I think that, so you look at those two examples, and boy, I just cannot tell you this time, you've got to be careful with what you're reading in the media. And I tell you, elected officials need to be careful, because I think one of the things we're starting to see now is elected officials are getting called out for actually retweeting or liking tweets, because that becomes, you know, reporters do the same daggum thing. And it's amazing to me. I wouldn't, if I was an elected official, I wouldn't like or retweet anything. But it does. It's a way of looking at what people are thinking, what elected officials are thinking. And, you know, we had Mayor Daley on the show here, and I grilled him pretty good about some of his comments. You know, his extreme comments, taking issues and trying to put them in a, you know, in a light that is more political than really problem solving. And I think that's sort of where we are now. When we start pivoting to the local scene, is we got to be careful with what's being said. I mean, look, I drilled John Daly. You got Commissioner Matlow. I like to call this the Daly Matlow show. You know, and you've got Commissioner Matlow who calls Blueprint a sham and then comes on the radio and says, well, you know, there's 27 projects and I'm only opposed to three. So really, Blueprint isn't a sham. It's just three projects he disagrees with. So we've got to be very careful, because, you know, the media takes that and says, Commissioner Matlow says that Blueprint's a sham. Well, he said that for effect. Maybe he's trying to, you know, appeal to people that think it's a sham. And then when you're on a radio show that goes to mostly conservative voters, maybe, you argue that, moderate, he says, well, no, I didn't mean it was a sham. I just meant that, you know, three of the 27 projects were not noted. So this is something you're going to have to look at, because what happens is the media, the way things are portrayed, are huge. And, you know, they have a big impact. And we'll keep an eye on that during this upcoming political season with a lot of local candidates running for office. It's important to know where they stand and where their sincerity is on these issues. So, all right. Well, when we get back, we'll talk about multi-use paths. That's going to be a problem, I think, for the next segment. But anyway, we'll give you the details and a heads up on what is coming up in regards to where these projects might be. You're listening to Above the Fold, and I'm Steve Stewart. We'll be back right after this quick break.
If it's local and it matters, it's Above the Fold with Steve Stewart on Real Talk 93.3.
Welcome back to Above the Fold here on Real Talk 93.3. Our Above the Fold is sponsored in part by the Medicare Help Desk. The Medicare Help Desk offers free consultations to help you navigate through the complicated processes and numerous types of plans available to you. There's no charge for their service whatsoever. Open enrollment is going on now through December 7th. So now is the time you can make changes to your Medicare Advantage or Part D prescription drug plans to take effect at the beginning of the year. There's so many options to consider, so having someone who knows the details and can point you in the right direction is essential. The Medicare Help Desk represents all major insurance companies and makes the process simple and easy. You can reach them at 850-632-0033 or online at themedicarehelpdesk.com. Again, that's themedicarehelpdesk.com. And we appreciate their sponsorship here on Above the Fold. All right. As I said, we're going to pivot to multi-use paths. The first one I wanted to talk about was something we've written about at TOS Reports previously. This is a path that is they're trying to build between Benton Road and Live Oak Plantation Road. It's going to be like a 12-foot wide bidirectional path. And again, when I saw this at first, I thought this was a home run. And, you know, it's people up in the Thomasville Road area at I-10 there at the Market District can get down to Midtown. But anyway, I got a couple phone calls about people that were concerned. A letter from Dr. Tom Haney, who is a noted orthopedic surgeon here in Tallahassee for almost 45 years, voiced concern to the point to where he's written, he had written basically an op-ed. So I wanted to highlight some points on this. And this is, you know, is all related to safety. Again, as he notes, this is going to be a bidirectional multi-use path between Thomasville Road, on Thomasville Road, between Benton Road and Live Oak Plantation Road. He has serious safety concerns. In fact, according to the criteria set by the National Organization Studying Safety Standards for these dual directional bicycle paths, the segment of Thomasville Road should never be considered as a safe option. Now, see, that's a pretty bold paragraph there. And the thing is what that does is put the burden back on the staff that's pushing this. And so he's talking about the American Association of State Highways and Transportation Officials. Interesting acronym. But anyway, I mean, this, so, you know, my point would be you take that, you lift that paragraph and you ask staff, so what's the validity of this pretty definitive paragraph written by this doctor? And so then he uses his own experience. For those of us who dealt with tragic consequences of serious accidents, safety is always a dominant factor. And it says the most urgent concern for paths of this type is well-documented blind spots. And so, you know, what he's saying is there's too many points where the path is going to cross roads, which, you know, is going to provide safety issues. And it says this National Safety Organization cited earlier specifically states that dual pathways should never be considered on heavily traveled roads with multiple side roads entrance, since this is unsafe for both cyclists and drivers. The study states that attempts to require bicyclists to yield or stop at each cross street or driveway are inappropriate and typically not effective. So, he notes here, due to the continuing development of housing north of I-10, traffic along this segment of highway will continue to get worse. With more than 800 miles of bike paths in our community, this project should yield to concerns for safety of our citizens. Now, it says here the 10 to 12-foot wide multiple-use pathway would allow two-directional flow for bicycles, motorized bikes, electric scooters, skateboards, joggers, walkers, and dogs. All these will have the right-of-way, making drivers responsible for any accidents. And, you know, he says this is not a NIMBY, not a my backyard issue. This is about saving lives. So obviously the issue here is safety. And, you know, so this is going to be something that's going to go back to the staff, who is arguing that, you know, this is something that should be done. It's going to be a quality of life issue. And I'm sure that they'll have a response to the safety issue. And so we'll get caught up with that. But again, I think this goes back to my original response on this, is that there are going to be people that have issues, and now there are more and more ways for them to get their, message out. And it's through social media, through blogs, and this is what's happening here. So the good news here is that, you know, this is a very detailed letter, and it's very focused on safety issues. So the staff, you know, are going to be able to respond. Elected officials could ask these questions and go from there. Now, the other trail, which is obviously, I don't know if this would be the same issue, but this is a more of a regional effort. The Capital Regional Transportation Planning Agency, and they is the one that's behind this, and they recently received an update on this U.S. 90 multi-use trail feasibility study. This was initiated in 2019, being developed to evaluate the usefulness of constructing a multi-use trail to connect Tallahassee to Monticello along U.S. 90. The project will stretch from Pedrick Road in Leon County east to Monticello, to the Monticello Bike Trail on the east side of Monticello in Jefferson County. Again, 10 to 12 foot wide trail will run approximately 21 miles. You know, this is like a great, you know, biking opportunity. According to the report that that the CRTPA received, the project hopes to provide a safe and continuous multimodal trail to connect Tallahassee to Monticello. And so this, is, again, is part of these shared use trails. And, you know, they haven't decided on a specific trail alignment. The public outreach on this, there's been two virtual meetings in April and May of 2021. But there's another meeting scheduled January 20th, 2022 at 5 o'clock at the Tallahassee East Side Branch Library, which is off of Pedrick, I believe. Now, Tallahassee reports, we have a story on this, and you can go look at the, I think they have, looks like they have four different trail options. And so you can go look at these. They vary in terms of where they have the alignments and constrained areas, which I guess they would have stop signs and whatnot. But so, again, I think that if you start looking at what we're doing here with these paths, it's about, you know, increasing the quality of life. And these things are so popular in other cities. I mean, there's one in Atlanta that goes right through downtown Atlanta that is, I mean, they have, there's businesses that now set up on the trail because they are so popular. I know that I think there's a couple in, there's a famous one in Asheville, North Carolina, very popular. So this is not a unique idea. I would think that these safety concerns have been addressed in other areas. And so it appears that that's going to be, you know, the main issue for both of these. And so we'll have to keep an eye on that. But, you know, one of the things that I think that we've heard for over the last, gosh, 10 to 20 years is about this ecotourism and people coming to Tallahassee. And, you know, one of the things that we have here is we're a, you know, sort of a small, big city. And, you know, we've, you know, you drive 15 miles either direction and we are in some pretty, you know, it's some pretty beautiful country. And the time of, you know, putting these trails out in those areas, I mean, this is what a lot of people are looking for when they go on vacations or when they're coming to stay at a place, you know, for a longer period of time. I mean, if you just look at this Thomasville Trail, I mean, going up to the Market District, there's a number of hotels in this area. And so you could, if you're staying there, you could take this bike trail down to Midtown, you've got a lot of different, obviously, options there for food and entertainment. So I don't know. We'll see if we can get past the safety issues and how legitimate they are. Dr. Haney obviously is very experienced and been around for a while, so I wouldn't discount what he says. My question would be is, can any of his concerns be mitigated? And then on this other issue with to Monticello, we'll try to get some more information after the public input on January 22nd. All right, when we get back, we're going to pivot to the blueprint meeting on the schedule for December 9th. I don't know if there's an agenda item on this, but there is an issue about this $20 million that was given to FSU. They had a meeting at the Lincoln Center in Frenchtown, and we'll get you an update on what they said. And a quote, a classic quote from Leon County Commissioner Bill Proctor. So stay tuned.
If it's local and it matters, it's Above the Fold with Steve Stewart on Real Talk 93.3.
Welcome back to Above the Fold here on Real Talk 93.3. Thanks for joining us today. I think probably everybody should be back at work today. I know yesterday the traffic was light, a little heavier this morning dropping off my daughter at high school. So maybe there was some vacation time used Monday. But anyway, again, thanks for tuning in. Wanted to turn our attention to this $20 million FSU payment. There's a town hall that was held by the sponsor or hosted by the NAACP Tallahassee branch. President Akbar said the group took action after a considerable public response. This is a report by WCTV. Now, this goes back, for those who aren't completely aware of this, economic development money that the Blueprint voted to give to FSU, $20 million. You cannot discuss this $20 million without discussing a couple of things, you know, in proper context. This is the economic development part of the money that I was against. I think Blueprint was working well with infrastructure, but there was a move to, and we voted for it and approved it, just like the Children's Services Council. And so there's a certain percentage of the Blueprint money that can go to what they call soft infrastructure economic development money. What we decided to do with it was give it all to upgrading athletic facilities at TCC, FAMU, and FSU. And so when you talk about this $20 million to FSU, what you can't leave out is that fact. There are people, and you know, the problem, we get back to this hypocrisy angle. There are people that voted for the TCC money and also the FAMU money, and now they're against the FSU money. And so, look, you know, there's a lot of different reasons to vote against this. I mean, I think we saw those in the Blueprint meeting. Brian Welch wanted it to be $15 million, so they had $5 million left as an incentive for any economic development projects that might be moving down the pike in the next couple of years. But, you know, the vote carried. And so now there's this hope that, you know, the vote was 8-4, but I think it only carried by one vote, to tell you the truth, because it needed a supermajority. So now there's this move to try to get up to reconsider it. It appears on December 9th, it looks like. And so they held this meeting, and, you know, I think they're obviously trying to make the public more aware. There was a little bit of outrage, obviously, on social media, and so now they want to keep festering this, obviously, so that they can have an impact on elected officials. They pointed out at this meeting that it's not really $20 million, but it's actually $27 million because they have to pay interest on the bond that they're floating, and also that it's going to dry up the fund. We've already talked about this. There's just no more money for economic development out of that pot. So as Akbar says, if any project comes along, it could be workforce development or something else. What happens then? And then there's also the sentiment that FSU can afford the stadium repairs without public dollars. It says here that, you know, nothing is going to stop FSU football. They have the money. They have the will. They can fix it themselves, but they shouldn't fix it on the backs of poor Tallahassee. So, you know, look, that's obviously, and we'll talk about that characterization, poor Tallahassee. Now, County Commissioner Bill Pachter voted for this funding, and you know, he was asked about that, and he argued that the $20 million for Doak was going to be used for the Convention Center initiative anyway. So the money was going to go to FSU either way. And then his quote, which I think is great, is, and this is what Proctor told WCTV, "There's not been a more successful performing arts center than Doak Cannibal Stadium, and in particular under the years of Jimbo Fisher and Coach Bobby Bowden." And so, you know, his point on that is that, look, this money is going to a good use. The Doak Campbell Stadium generates a huge amount of money for the community. And so, you know, so there is, you could argue, when bipartisan is probably not the correct word to use, but you could argue that, you know, from the people, the 12 people that voted, look, there were people that disagree on a lot of different things, people that supported this, Commissioner Proctor being one. You know, and I think that what we're starting to see here, again, is this continuing argument about two different Tallahassees and one Tallahassee getting, you know, all the money. You see the quote that FSU shouldn't fix it on the backs of poor Tallahassee. Well, you know, this Blueprint money is coming from sales tax revenue, which is really paid not from poor Tallahassee. It's mostly paid in from, I would think, wealthy Tallahassee, to be honest with you. And so, you know, look, we all want to have nice things, but this whole argument, and you hear this on the progressive wing of the city commission, is that somebody is being ignored. And I think there is, you know, a lot of good research out there and documents that have shown the amount of money, hundreds of millions of dollars that have been invested on the south side. And all you've got to look is to look in the southeast quadrant of Tallahassee and the amount of money, the economic development that's taken place there from all kind of different government entities, and some just private sector. You look at the federal side of this, you've got the VA building that's being put in place. You look from the blueprint side, you've got the Orange Avenue widening. You got sidewalks everywhere on Orange Avenue up to Monroe Street. You look at from the school board situation. Look at Rickards. They've put in almost $50 to $60 million in infrastructure at Rickards High School on the south side. We talked about this a little bit. The English property over there that's being developed to create, I think, it could thousands and thousands of new homes. And so, you know, I think that this myth about poor Tallahassee and that it's there's two Tallahassees, this is being promoted by those who obviously want resources dedicated to specific areas. But, you know, just like this Children's Services Council debate, you know, at some point we've got to start asking, what are we getting for our money, or what needles are being moved? Because, you know, we're hearing the 32304 narrative, this zip code being the poorest zip code in the state of Florida. We're hearing about, you know, 20 to 25% poverty rate in Leon County. And I'm beginning to wonder exactly, first of all, how is this being measured? Where are they getting their numbers? We've got so many open jobs that are starting at $15 an hour that I don't know how you could argue that, you know, we have a poverty problem. We've got free food at schools now. I mean, every school, it's not, you know, for everyone. So I just don't know how, I don't know where you get to that point of where you can continue to say that. Now, there are obviously the people that are arguing this have a lot of vested interest. You know, they're either, you know, they're working for nonprofits that want more money. You know, are they politicians who are looking for votes? But this, I think, is going to be interesting to see this unfold over the next year as we look at these local campaigns. What is the negative side to our economic development here in Tallahassee? Are we in a point where we are actually ignoring an area? Now, look, you can say that we have poverty in 32304, Frenchtown's struggling, and there's no doubt that there's pockets there. But to argue that we have not tried to provide economic development there over the last 20 to 25 years, there are attempts, and it's been documented over and over again. So my point is, maybe the issue is not money. Maybe it's something that's not driven by money. I don't know if you can put your finger on it, but the point being, and that would be a good thing if you found out that it wasn't about money, because then you can move and start really addressing the issue. But I think for now, we've got a bunch of leaders that are arguing that it's about money, that, you know, because we're, you know, giving money to FSU, it is hurting poor Tallahassee. I don't think that's a very good argument when we just voted for a Children's Services Council that's going to be pumping $10 million a year into areas that are distressed. And I mean, look, over 5 years, that's going to be $50 million, if not more, that we're dedicating to that. That's in addition to what we were already putting into these areas. So it's time for us to take an inventory of exactly where this money's going and where the needles are moving. Because if that poverty rate, that poverty number has been the same for 20 years, I bet. And it's, where's the money going? If we're not moving, how are they measuring poverty? I mean, if we start putting money there and start providing food, you would think the poverty rate would go down because of the amount of money that we've gotten for COVID relief and we've put in these areas. We've talked about that. Leon County has put millions in these neighborhoods. And so I just don't want to see the narrative that there's two different Tallahassees, because look, there may be geographically the way Tallahassee has been laid out, there's four different segments and we can look at those and see what's happening. But to say that we don't have the money or we haven't invested the money, I mean, we've invested a lot of money in all segments, all sectors of Leon County. And I think it's probably time to look at some, a couple of different issues to figure out exactly what our problem is. All right. When we get back, we'll turn our attention to some state issues. Stay tuned. I'm Steve Stewart. You're listening to Above the Fold.
If it's local and it matters, it's Above the Fold with Steve Stewart on Real Talk 93.3.
All right, welcome back to Above the Fold here on Real Talk 93.3, our last segment of the day. Appreciate you tuning in. I wanted to pivot to a couple of state issues. One has a little bit of local relevance, and so we'll do that now. Duval County, some Florida men were charged with falsifying voter registration forms. And the point of bringing this story up is to note the impact of these third-party groups. What happened was these third-party voter registration groups, they go out and hire people. And they're paying people to register voters on a per-application basis. And the two men were charged and arrested, were intending to register as many people as possible in order to get paid per application. But what had happened was they were actually falsifying some of these voter registrations. The Duval County Supervisor of Elections, Mike Hogan, said the discovery of more than 60 dead voter registrations that were processed by these two gentlemen does not indicate a lapse in the Duval County elections integrity process overall. It just shows, quote, the diligence of the people who are working through this process to make sure that everything is right, not just the accuracy of the vote count, but the validity of our voter roll. Now, he's correct to point out that this wasn't political. It was just about making money. In other words, you were doing dead people, registering dead people, so you're getting paid for that. But I think what this does is it opens up this whole point, again, back to some of the security issues with regards to having all these different third-party groups able to go out and register voters. Now, there was an investigation going on in Georgia by the state level on some of these groups who were registering people out of town, people that were not able to vote. And here in Florida, I mean, there are hundreds of groups that are approved to register voters. So the point being, yes, in this situation, if you take the supervisor of elections person at his word, is not about politics. It was more about making money. But if these two people can do this, now they did get caught, but you know, they got caught because of signature matching. And so the point would be, you know, you've got all these groups that are going out and registering voters. They're going out and knocking on doors to get people to register. And so, you know, the problem, and we saw this in Georgia, is that with the COVID pandemic, then you go back and collect, you know that they're registered, you know when the ballot's going to show up, and then you go back and knock on the door and you collect it. Now, as I've said on this show a number of times, when I walk in and vote in person, I get the ballot and nobody talks to me while I fill out my ballot, and I don't talk to anybody when I turn it in. You know, going out and collecting ballots at someone's house is not the same as voting in person. And so I'm not going to rehash all that. But this, what happened in Duval County goes to show you another weakness in the process. And yes, when you get hundreds of these groups, this is going to happen. The question is it what magnitude is it happening? And we saw an issue in North Carolina. This is not a Democrat-Republican issue. In North Carolina, it was Republicans that were doing it. Obviously, the accusations or allegations in Georgia revolve around Democrats. But again, you know, I think the safest way to vote is obviously in person. And I don't care if it takes 2 weeks to get everybody to vote. I'd rather have 2 weeks of in-person voting than sending out ballots in the mail, given the situation we're at today. All right, another issue here that has a local relevance. We did a story on this. We did a couple stories on this, and this is a big issue on the family with the daughter at Deer Lake Middle School who was told they had no right to be involved with this gender transition plan that the Deer Lake Middle School officials were putting in place. The parents filed a federal lawsuit. We covered that in detail here. But the family is real ticked off. They're appearing everywhere. I saw that they were on Fox News Nation. The mother, January Littlejohn, is a mental health expert, and she gave about a 10-minute speech at the what's the name of the organization? The Florida Family Policy Council. And it was entitled "How Gender Ideology Almost Destroyed My Family." And the idea here is that they had this daughter who was going through gender issues, which they blamed a little bit on the pandemic. The family did, and they got her counseling. They tried to facilitate some of the issues at school by letting her use a nickname. And the next thing they know, the school officials were using that allowance to go ahead and start asking her about what bathroom she preferred, what name she wanted to use. And I think the thing that was the most hurtful is that they actually had in the gender transition plan, a way to hide from the parents what was going on at school. But the thing that resulted in the federal lawsuit was the fact that the school board basically told her that their decision to do this was supported by law. A 13-year-old middle school girl who is having a problem with a gender issue does not have to, they have a right to privacy. And so they have to get, the daughter has to give consent to the school for the parents to be involved. Now, this is something that's going on all over the country, and they filed a federal lawsuit. You can go to the Florida Capital Star, and you can actually see her presentation. Again, it's short, 10 minutes, I think. And, 11 minutes. And I think it's worth a listen. Because I think, one of the things that we're seeing here in the state of Florida, which has got a Republican governor, Republican legislature, we're having these issues in school boards, and they're actually using state law to say that it's okay. Another issue that we ran into is, we had asked about, how do you promote a social campaign in middle schools? In other words, how do you pick a social campaign? And, it looks to me like it's based on the advocacy of whatever teacher is motivated to do it. And, they use these bullying resources that are on the website at FDOE, Florida Department of Education, as a backstop or a rationale for being able to do this. And so, we've got to look into this more, but I don't know if they, when you give a website that is a link to a website on a government website, which is basically providing direction to school boards, why are we providing links to advocacy groups as a way to develop policy on these very controversial issues? It's something we're going to spend more time talking about. But I mean, again, you go to Florida DOE and you've got 4 or 5 links on bullying and how to deal with gender issues, and you click on it and you leave the DOE website and you go to advocacy sites. And I don't understand. That's not where we should be getting our direction. We should be getting it from our policymakers, which are your school board, and they should be getting good direction from the state. And so we're going to definitely try to get some DOE officials on the record of, first of all, is this something they know is even there, and are they supporting this? This is the lead to where everything's being nationalized, because these national groups are getting their claws into the school boards. And they're going around the legislature, they're going around FDOE, and they're going to the specific school boards, getting their software accepted, and then they're providing all these opportunities for people in the classrooms, these teachers that are motivated to promote certain positions on these controversial issues. They have the resources to do it, and nobody knows unless parents are involved. And look, parents, they're trying to raise their families. They got to go to work. and they don't want to have to deal with this. And so definitely an issue we're going to spend more time on. All right, thanks for tuning in today. We'll be back on Thursday. Enjoy the weather. Get outside. This is a beautiful time between Thanksgiving and Christmas not to be so stressed. There'll be plenty of time in January to be stressed. So enjoy that, and we'll be back with hopefully I'll try to be more uplifting on Thursday. So tune in then. I'm Steve Stewart. You're listening to Above the Fold. It's going to be a bright